Welcome to Rails with Jason. If you enjoyed today's episode and want more Rails tips and advice, head over to codewithjason.com, where I keep all my Rails articles and videos. Now on to the episode. Welcome. Today I'm here with Adam Hawkins. Adam teaches teams to build and ship software faster on his podcast, Small Batches. Adam, welcome to the show.
Hey, Jason. Happy to be here.
Glad to have you here. And I've been on your podcast before. So, dear listener, if you like listening to me talk, which apparently you do at least to some extent because you're listening to this podcast, you can go check out that one with me and Adam. I thought it turned out really good. And Adam, can you tell us a little bit about your podcast and like what kind of topics you tend to discuss?
Yeah. So on my podcast, I try to hit the intersection of sort of business software, like team architecture, software architecture, delivery architecture, all the things that teams and organizations have to consider to create, you know, like fast feedback from development to production so that like we as engineers can, you know, do our work quickly, deliver business results quickly, and be happy while we do it.
Yeah, I think that's great. I think you're providing a much needed service to the world because like from my personal experience in working with teams, there's just like so much inefficiency in the workflows, like developers working on stories that are like, for example, not sufficiently crisply scoped. And so it's not even clear, like, when is this done and when it's not done? How would you know when it's done? What does it even mean for a story to be done in general? All that kind of stuff. And so, like, I see DevOps in large part as being about, like, addressing all of those inefficiencies. And so, like, that's huge. I think it's not unreasonable that you could take a team and, like, 2x their output by, like, taking their inefficiencies and cleaning all that stuff up and tightening it up.
Well, you can go far more than 2x. And let me give you a story here. So I was at the DevOps Enterprise Summit like 2 weeks ago, and one of the presenters did a story of Project Kessel Run. Project Kessel Run is, you know, referenced in Han Solo's historic Kessel Run from Star Wars. The idea is that this is the US Air Force here. So we're talking the DoD. And they had, you know, a transformative initiative to completely rework how they built, shipped, and deployed software at the Air Force. And, you know, you can imagine what it was like to do, like to be a developer in the DoD of all things, right? Imagine the controls, all the complex things you have to worry about just to make like a single line change and get that into production. I mean, over here, we're talking about Agile and DevOps, but, you know, they're still following the waterfall model effectively. So you can imagine how long the change cycles are. And one of the people familiar with the project was saying it was taking like 2 years to just go through a project. So they, you know, sort of fast forward through all of this, but they were able to like cut that down to like 2 months or so and be able to like take a brand new project, greenfield it from scratch, like have an automated whole like platform built in-house, like get through all the compliance, all the things so that the developers could actually just have continuous delivery to the secure production network. So like if they can do it and have, you know, like 100 or 1,000x improvement in their performance and their quality, and even like if you care about this, the happiness of the engineers, like if you change the way you work and the way you think, you can have, you know, absurdly high ROI on that effort.
Oh yeah. And of course people should care about the happiness of the engineers, just one, because like it's good to be a good person and care about how happy your employees are, but people are going to be so much more productive if they're enjoying their work than if they're not.
Oh yeah. And like that comes back to, I think, your last appearance on my show with regard to automated testing. It's like if you have automated testing, you'll have much more confidence in the work that you do, and that will make you happier because you can go about your work more efficiently and more confidently. You know, you're able to take on bigger projects. You're able to work on smaller projects more effectively. You know, there's, we can go on and on about all the benefits of these practices.
Yeah, absolutely. So the topic that you and I were talking about pre-show is kind of, what technologies do you need for your project when you're maybe starting a new project, or in some other scenario, deciding what do you need? And I think specifically we're talking about infrastructure. I don't know if we're going to talk about only infrastructure or other stuff too, but just to kind of tee up that topic, how do we want to come into this? Like, we were talking about Docker and Kubernetes and all that kind of stuff. I guess I'll turn it over to you and let you kind of kick us off there.
Yeah, so I think it's an important aspect to consider when, say, you're starting a new project, like you're greenfielding a new project, or let's say that you come to a new team or a new project that's sort of in flight, or maybe they're transitioning, or, you know, they're growing, whatever, and you hit this inflection point where you think, I need something different. What do I need? Like, what actually will solve my problem? And I know that personally, like myself, I've been a victim of the, like, the new shiny, like, oh, there's this new thing called Docker. Like, let's just do everything with Docker. Or, you know, there's Kubernetes, like, let's just do everything with that. Like, just a little bit of the backstory, you know, I adopted Docker at Saltside back when it hit 1.0. So like that, like right then. So if you can imagine jumping into that technology stack then, is way different than what it is now. So kind of what I wanted to talk to you about and share some of my conversations from like our own personal experience with listeners is how to think about what the what technologies you need, like what actually solves your problem, and with regard to what goals do you have? Because rarely the goal is to choose a specific technology, but it's to actually solve a particular problem. You know, like, is it a technical problem that you have? Is it like a reliability thing that you need a certain kind of deployment strategy? Like, how are you doing? Like, you don't need necessarily like a specific like CI system, but you need a CI system. Like, okay, if you're using cloud, what do you actually need from that cloud provider? You know, like, or do you even need all that stuff in the big, like at the first place? You know, like, is it enough just to get Heroku and go on with your life and not think about it? You know, like, what is the actual problem you're trying to solve, and not being sort of distracted by all of the tech that maybe you want to use or want to try, you know?
Maybe we could do a quick case study. I'm curious what technologies you would use for my project that I'm working on right now. So I'm the only person working on it. The traffic is a low load of traffic. It's just used by, it's used by a brick and mortar business with currently three offices and like between 35 and 40 people using it. But they are using it all day, every day to do like really important stuff. How would you approach that and like determining what the hosting needs are and technology stack and all that stuff?
Well, I wouldn't even start there, truthfully. The thing that I immediately jumped onto is that you're the only person working on this thing. So that if you're the only person, then naturally there's only a certain amount of stuff you can fit in your head, right? So then you have to then prioritize, like, what are the things you actually need to do? Like, hey, are you focused on like building and iterating on that product? Is that the prime directive? Or are you focused on all of these other things? And then that just really comes down to, what stuff can you do that yourself that is directly valuable versus what stuff is better delegated to someone else? So, I mean, I have high confidence in saying that I would just use Heroku and not even think about it. Because the thing that, like, you're the only person working on it, it's probably a better use of your time to focus on, you know, making commits to the project that move the product forward or the project, whatever that is, rather than what kind of infrastructure or hosting you need. Because the thing I think is the most important is to be aware of the cognitive load on yourself, because ultimately you are the bottleneck in this system. Like, since you're the only person, like, what you can do or can't do is what matters most. So if what matters most is for you to actually make some commits to that project and develop it and make some commits, like get some features or bug fixes out, choose whatever technology allows you to do that the fastest. And my guess is something like Heroku. You don't need to worry about like infrastructure, you know, whatever, until, you know, it's a problem. And Heroku will be cheaper in terms of like your time, but more importantly, that offloads, takes care of the cognitive load required of infrastructure, so you can focus on what's actually important in your role on that project.
Yeah, that seems like the exact right choice to me. Sadly, in this case, for legal reasons, we can't use Heroku. Mm. So what would your thought be then?
Well, that's a bummer, because unfortunately, like, there's nothing that, like, at least that I found that approximates Heroku in another context, you know, because then you get down to like, how can I recreate something like that? And one thing I can certainly say is don't use Elastic Beanstalk ever. Friends, don't let friends use Elastic Beanstalk. But then you just try to find something that is like as close enough to like that kind of real platform as a service, and not like lower like infrastructure as a service, you know?
Sorry, can we just real quick say why no Elastic Beanstalk?
Oh yeah, it doesn't work. It's not good. It doesn't actually solve the problems that you think it will do. Like, it's not reliable. You still have to manage infrastructure. You know, it's just kind of a false promise for like what you expect. I think if you're looking at Elastic Beanstalk and thinking like, oh, I can just push my app to this thing and it will work, I won't have to think about all these different concerns. Not true. Not true.
Yeah, I've tried to like boil it down to the most succinct reason why I can. And what I came up with is it's like the worst of both worlds. You get like inflexibility, but you still have to manage the infrastructure.
Yeah, pretty much. It's just the worst of everything. It's like if you're trying to use it, then like you still have to manage infrastructure. So like at that point, you might as well, if you can, just forego it and focus on like managing infrastructure with golden images or, you know, something like that. Or if you can't, then you're stuck because you still have to care about all this infrastructure that you didn't want to in the first place. But it's not called Google App Engine anymore, but whatever they call it on GCP was actually pretty decent and definitely much better than Elastic Beanstalk. I don't think you actually can find anything to close to like platform as a service in terms of like, hey, I built an application that runs as a process. There's certainly nothing like that on AWS. And this is where you come to, you know, the discussion of like serverless and these other things, these entirely different application models and architectures. Because like, if you say could build your application as serverless, then, you know, you could just deploy it to any of these platforms and have a pretty decent experience, I'd say, compared to like if you were trying to find something like Heroku-esque on any of these cloud providers.
Okay. So no Elastic Beanstalk. I'm in complete agreement as somebody who ran a production application on Elastic Beanstalk for several months and then had to painfully switch away. But hey,
same,
now I know.
Me too.
Yeah. Okay, so I'm using AWS. How would you approach that? Like, would you use... I happen to be using Ansible and like nothing else. I'm not using Kubernetes or Docker or anything like that. How would you think about that aspect of it?
Well, what's the sort of the, in my mind, the easiest possible infrastructure to manage if you are like, don't want to get into the, oh man, I need Kubernetes and all these infrastructure things, containers and, you know, blah, 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 the scope balloons. Like, one thing that's really easy to fit in your mind and I think understand conceptually is the concept of a golden image deployment. So the idea here is use some configuration management tool like Ansible, Packer, whatever, some way to create an Amazon machine image or whatever they would call it on the particular cloud platforms. But basically it's an image that contains the version of the source code you want to run. You put that in an autoscaling group. You put that behind a load balancer. That gives you rolling deploys that can open the door to canary deploys, opens the door to blue-green deploys, like progressive rollouts. You have elastic scaling because you can move up, you can move down, you have reliability, and you have a load balancer. Like, all you need is like a simple playbook that says build the image, upload that image, change the image in the autoscaling group, and the cloud platform will take care of everything else. You don't have to worry about like long-lived infrastructure. It's all immutable. It's honestly just a very good strategy. Like, you don't need much more than that, you know?
Okay. So maybe we can unpack some of these terms, because I'm going to risk being like overly explanatory of what's maybe some basic stuff. But I don't know, just as of a few years ago, I didn't really know what a load balancer was. So maybe we can explain what some of these things are. We don't have to go through every single term and give a dictionary definition or anything like that. But maybe to frame the question this way, what are some of the principles that somebody should make sure they're familiar with if you're put in a position like I was, where I'm a developer, now I have to be responsible for all this hosting and stuff too. I don't have any experience with that other than Heroku, which means I don't have to do anything. So I didn't gain any experience managing infrastructure, because you don't have to manage infrastructure with Heroku. What kind of concepts should I be aware of?
Well, I think the first one is continuous delivery and hopefully continuous deployment, which is the idea, like, say, if you're working on Heroku or you're working with Heroku, you know, you would have had some pipeline, hopefully, that like tests your application, builds it, and hopefully at the end pushes it to Heroku. So you have that separation of concerns between like testing and your overall deployment. So you should first concern yourself with what technologies allow you to keep that fast feedback, like that fast feedback loop going. So whatever technology you choose, you have to be able to build like a push button deployment process with it, so that when you do need to deploy, you hit the button and that things work. That's the prime concern there. And then you can meet that objective using any number of different technologies.
Okay. So, you know, actually that part is like surprisingly non-trivial. You would think in the year 2020 that it would be non-trivial, that it would be trivial. But it's surprisingly non-trivial. I had to like roll my own deployment using Ansible, and I had to do so much work. It was like days and days and days of work just to be able to deploy my application to AWS.
Yeah, I agree with you. It's way more complicated than it needs to be. But this is where we sort of run the risk of leveling up into these higher level abstractions, like, you know, oh, you have Kubernetes. Well, you can just deploy application in Kubernetes. Well, yes, but now you need to A, run Kubernetes, and then B, know Kubernetes, you know?
Yeah, it's like it can be simple if you do a bunch of complicated stuff first.
Yeah. So like, unfortunately, there just is, like in my experience, no really good out-of-the-box solution to this problem. So like, if you have to create something from scratch, then you need to focus on, you know, the smallest stuff that you can actually do and understand. Because if you can't understand it, you can't troubleshoot it. And if you're responsible for production operations, then you can't be behind something that you are unable to like actually fix, you know? Like, I really feel for people who have been thrown into like an application running in some like cloud or some container orchestration platform that they don't understand how the lower levels, like the lower level nuances of that system, are actually impacting their application, you know? So that's why I say that something like golden images plus like virtual machines is like the easiest thing, I think, to start with, you know?
Because you don't have the term golden image. What do you mean by that?
Golden images. The idea here is like, you, I'm guessing that listeners will have used or have heard of an ISO, you know, back in the day when you used to burn CDs or burn DVDs or whatever. Somebody would make a copy of that thing, distribute the image, and then anybody could, you know, create a system from that image, burn it to a disk and reuse it. So that was sort of like, you know, the golden master copy of this. Like, you can imagine a record, like an actual physical record, you know, you put on a record player, they would actually create a master image and press all the other records from that, right? So the idea of a golden image, when we're talking about like software or software delivery, the idea is that you have something that you can just recreate from. Like, when you distribute, probably heard like iOS versions updates, they have what's called like the gold master that everybody receives. And so it's just sort of this copy that can be recreated or distributed. So does that
Yeah, it's like the canonical version of that image.
Right. So like if you have, you know, we're talking about Git, for example, you know, everybody has the branch master, they can check out that, and you know that everybody will have the same content when they're at the same commit, you know. So the idea here is that you can create an image that includes the source code of your application and all of the dependencies required to run your application. Like if you're talking a Rails application, you might say build an image with Ubuntu that includes Ruby and includes all the system dependencies required to do, you know, bundle install. It includes everything, right? You might even have like Passenger in there with Nginx or whatever. You'd have everything that you need to run your application so that you can create a virtual machine from that image. So when it starts, your application is just running on that VM.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And that's basically what I have with Ansible. Well, I don't know if it's an image. It's really not an image. It's more of a script. Mm. Ansible user? So like
yes,
Ansible,
it's
organized in playbooks. So I have these playbooks, and then the playbooks I think are comprised of commands or whatever they're called, mm-hmm. where it's basically like install Passenger, install such and such until I've like created an instance with all the software on it that it needs.
Right. So my guess is that you run the Ansible playbooks on the machines themselves. Is
right.
that true?
Mm-hmm.
Right. So this, what I'm talking about is something different. So you're running Ansible on the hosts themselves to configure the machines. So what I'm talking about is using something like Ansible to run on a machine, and then from that, once you get to that desired end state, save that state as an image. And then you can launch your application from that image.
Why is that better? Is it faster?
It's immutable. So what that gives you, if like, say, if those... So let's say, let's contrast this approach to what you're doing right now. So let's say that in your current approach, you have, let's just say for the sake of argument, you have three different machines running somewhere. You know, you'll SSH into those machines, you'll run Ansible on them to get them into the correct state. And okay, so then what happens if one of those machines dies? What do you do? What happens if you need to create a new machine? So in that scenario, let's say a new machine comes up, but then for some reason, the package registry is down, or you can't clone your application, or for some reason, something inhibits the running of this playbook, right? What do you do? There's all these sort of transient things that can happen in that process. So on the other hand, if you had run like your playbook to create an image, you know that at any point in time, you can always create a new instance of your application. This is what we call immutable infrastructure. So like in your situation now, sure, you're the only person. So you know what you did on those servers, but if you imagine that there's 2, 3, 4, maybe other people, you don't know if somebody went into one of their special favorite servers and made some changes that you don't know about. Maybe they're not committed back to source control. You know, you can't be certain of the current state.
Yeah.
Plus, you still have to solve that, okay, what happens if a new machine comes up? What if I have to scale? How do I keep all these machines in sync, right? And then also, how do you do deploys, right? Is it like SSH in a machine, check out some code, restart some processes? Like, how does that work with regard to like rolling deploys? You know, there's a whole other level of questions you have to answer when you start to get into the approach of, I have, you know, let's just call it static infrastructure that I change when I need to like roll out code or make changes to the infrastructure, compared to the immutable infrastructure approach when you can just tear it down whenever you want and recreate it and be certain that it will end up in the correct state.
Yeah, the opposite of immutable infrastructure, of course, is Snowflake infrastructure, where it's like,
yeah,
okay, this machine started off in this certain knowable state because we generated it off of this Ansible playbook, but then 2 months later, somebody SSH'd in and manually applied some changes, and now the state of that machine is different from what it originally was, and the state is no longer knowable or replicable, and obviously that is bad. So what I have now, it's like, it's not completely immutable. It's not completely Snowflake. It's way better than just manually SSHing in and running all this stuff on the command, just typing it in, you know, way better than that. But it's still not as good as that image thing that you're talking about, because I completely get it. Like, I run my main provisioning playbook, but then I have like other playbooks that I run too. And I have to remember, like, okay, I run playbook A and then playbook B, and that's all I have to do. But I don't know, what if like I get woken up at 3 a.m. and there's some terrible bug and I have to do this real quick? I don't want to be like, furrowing my brow over these playbooks and being like, wait a second, last time I did this 3 months ago, how did I do it again? So I can definitely see the benefits of just having an image that you can just pop it open and there you go.
Well, let me give you another alternate take on that. It's sort of a joke in software that the most effective way to fix a problem is to turn it on and off again. It happens to work surprising amount of times. But if you have mutable infrastructure, you can't just turn it off, because if you turn it back on, you don't know what state it will be in.
And whereas in this case, maybe you mean not literally turning it off and turning it on, but destroying it and creating a new one or something like that.
Right. Like if, say, for example, if you had to terminate a VM for some reason, you know, and you then it's going to start up again. Well, what state is it in? You don't know. But if you have immutable infrastructure, then, hey, you'll see like, hey, there's a problem on this instance of like on this VM or this application server or whatever. Okay, well, I can kill it. Maybe that will fix it and it will start up again. If it doesn't, you know, you can move on in like your troubleshooting process. But you can just do that thing. And conversely, like what's also possible is if you have immutable infrastructure, given it's also been managed with some sort of code, you could tear it down, create it again, and you could do that to create new environments. You could create like a staging environment, a test environment, some sort of like preview environments. You know, you can do all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I have a problem right now where my laptop is the only laptop on the planet from which I can work on my application. And So just last week I ordered a new laptop so that I can have some redundancy. And I think maybe this can transition us into another topic, which will sadly probably be all we can fit in the time we have. But in order to set up this whole situation that I have on my laptop, situation, I guess you call it a development environment, so I can set up this development environment on my other laptop, I don't want to have a Snowflake laptop. So I think what I maybe want to do, although I'm not sure, is to Dockerize my application for development. And I didn't realize until relatively recently that there's multiple kinds of Dockerization. You can Dockerize something for production, or you can Dockerize it for development, or maybe you can Dockerize it in such a way that it achieves both. But anyway, it seems maybe smart to do something like that so that when I put it on my new laptop, I'm not running everything manually to get it into the state it needs to be in. I just check out my Docker image and run that. Based on your facial expression, it sounds like maybe you have some thoughts on that.
Oh, of course I have some thoughts on that. But I'm actually really happy you asked, like brought up this point, because it comes down to like, so the question is, say, what happens when somebody else needs to work on the project? Because it's different to solve for one versus solve for N. Those are two distinct, different solutions. So I've gone through this whole process and like back and forth in terms of say like, hey, let's Dockerize everything. Let's Dockerize some parts of it. You know, like, and as you said, you can containerize applications for production. You can containerize them for other uses also. But I think the question that you're getting to is how can I create immutable infrastructure or use some sort of like configuration management / infrastructure as code to actually codify my dev environment such that if something happens, I know that I can just, you know, start working again without having to recreate the world. So using containers in development is, I think, generally a good thing. But then the question is, how far are you willing to wade into that pool? And how knowledgeable are you? And how much are you willing to sort of take on to achieve that goal? So like there's two, like just give you like different ends of this spectrum. So let's say that one end of the spectrum is you have no sort of configuration management on your machine. Somebody just checks out code and then that's it. They have to then figure out like what all needs to be installed. Like, do they have a proper version of Ruby or Node or Python, whatever? You don't know. So that's a different, that's in the README. They'll handle that, right? And then there's like the next level, which is, hey, you need something like MySQL or Postgres. Well, how is Postgres installed? Hey, what version of Postgres is it? You know, like all of these things are really important because it might not be compatible with one version, or like the one version you have may not be available in the package repository or whatever, you know. So then you can have like nothing. You can have something like Homebrew or a simple script that just does like brew install or like apt-get install or like start these services, like make sure all this stuff is installed. You can take it like one step further and containerize your application in the sense of like, instead of doing like Rails server, you'll do something like Docker run, you know, my app dev, which will start the app in a container. And then you get into the questions of, well, how do I do like hot code reloading on all these other things? Like, is it as fast as it was if it wasn't containerized? Like, is this putting some extra like overhead or cognitive load into the process? And then like, how do I keep this up to date? Well, now I have like Docker running on my machine and, you know, images and distributing these images. And then you still have to consider like how you run the databases, the data stores, all the like other backend services. You know, it's not as simple as it sounds, right? So I'll give you, I started like way back when I mentioned like we adopted Docker when I hit 1.0. And we said, oh yes, we're gonna containerize everything because containers will give us all this immutability, will be easy to work with and yada, yada, yada. That turned out to be more or less true, but sufficient effort required to actually achieve that. And now what I recommend is sort of like an 80-20 type solution to that problem, which is, let's say that you're developing a Rails application on macOS and you depend on something like, you know, Postgres or Redis or, you know, whatever. Run those things as containers. You know, use Docker Compose, put all that in the Docker Compose file. That will give you an easy way to maintain immutability of those backing services. You can run any version of a database just by using like the official tagged images from Docker Hub. Like if you need MySQL 5.6, you can run that on Docker Hub. You find it on Docker Hub. If you need whatever version, you can use that. That also gives you the ability to distribute like test data, like seed data that you can run into these databases. You can create like different versions to use in different tests. Like if you want to test on one version or the other. And then when it comes to like the application side, and like if you're on macOS, then it's just easy enough to use something like ASDF, which is a version manager, like a multi-language version manager. So you can manage stuff like Node.js, Ruby, Python, you know, any type of tool can be managed with ASDF. And then you can write like a simple script that just makes sure you have like the proper brews installed. You can use a brew file for that. You know, you don't have to like jump all the way into that pool where, you know, you can just do like git clone, bundle install, like Docker Compose up, and then Rails server.
In this scenario, would I have to do things like, for example, if I want to do a Rails migration, would I have to do Docker Compose run Rails DB migrate?
No, because in this scenario, you're not actually running your application in a container. You're actually running the application on your host. So it's like easy enough to manage the small level of host dependencies just using like the brew file or something like that. And then you can start the databases and those ports would be exposed on, you know, your local host. So you would just configure like dburl to be, you know, localhost colon 3306 or whatever the Postgres port was. I can't remember.
And then would my Ruby version be managed locally, like not inside of Docker?
Exactly.
And that seems like a reasonable trade-off because just the act of, I don't know how people get around this, because just the act of typing Docker Compose run Rails as the prefix to everything is just so tedious, and it seems like totally not worth it.
Well, that's what you have shell aliases for. You know, you have all of these, like, higher level little abstractions to.
And I think I made one, you know, it was like DCR or something for Docker Compose Rails. But that just feels, I don't know, it's like aesthetically displeasing to have to switch for. I've been doing Rails, you know, typing the word Rails as a prefix for everything for like 9 years. And now I like switch to something else. It just feels like, I don't know, for some reason it bothers me to. But I guess you can alias Rails to Docker Compose Run Rails. You could do that, I suppose.
Or something. But it's like, who cares? You know, like, what are you actually trying to solve with this, with these tools? And one thing I think is really handy about that particular approach is that you know that all the code we're loading and all the other stuff, like authentication to package repositories is another thing. So like if you have to do like bundle install and you have a gem in a private repo, the moment that you put that in a Docker file, you're going to have to pass some credentials to that to the Docker build command. So you can now access that private repo. It just adds like a whole nother layer of stuff that you, like, if you don't have a problem, you don't need to create a problem.
Right. Yeah. Right? Sometimes
it's like the same thing about the VMs that I was talking about earlier. Like, you don't have to jump to containers. You know, you can just use like the same sort of process you have. Like, if you imagine you have some script that does like brew install, you know, A, B, and C, bundle install, and does like, you know, Rails server, you know, you could put that same thing into a script that does like apt-get install and then configure something and starts an application server. And boom, you know, you're pretty close to having some like a bootstrapped, you know, immutable infrastructure that you can use for your production or staging deploys and build on that.
What didn't occur to me was the hybrid approach. I didn't even realize that was possible because when I started using Docker, so I like Dockerized my application for development, partly just to, as an exploration to see if I could do it. And I ran into these problems that were kind of deal breakers, which are like when I run my RSpec and Capybara tests, I like to be able to see the browser sometimes. It's like, well, with Docker, how do I do that? I'm sure it's possible, but it's like, okay, now I have to do 14 hours of research to find the answer to do this. And there were like a number of issues like that. So I'm like, okay, this is maybe work worth doing, but I don't have time to do this right now, so I'm not going to go down this road right now. But if I can do a hybrid approach where I can run Rails, Redis, Postgres, Sidekick, whatever else using Docker, and then I can just connect to the Postgres instance inside of my Docker container, but not be in my Docker container when I'm executing my Rails commands and stuff like that. That seems great because it eliminates a lot of that overhead.
Yeah. And like that's where actually the real, I think the harder problem is. One other thing you can be bit by if, say, you're a consultant or you're some freelancer who's working on multiple projects, and maybe one uses version 5 of a database and one uses version 6. How are you going to run those different versions on your machine such that they're not in conflict with each other? Using Docker for that is actually a really easy solution because you can just start version 5 with project A and version 6 with project B. And there's no conflict.
And you don't have to, you know? You don't have to Dockerize the whole application. You can just run the database instance inside a Docker container. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
That seems great. Yeah. I did not realize that. Okay. This, that is like my main takeaway from this conversation, I think. You know, maybe the listener will have a different takeaway. But for me personally, that is like so valuable to realize that you don't have to. Docker is not like an all or nothing thing where you have to go all in and Dockerize every aspect of your application. You can just take bits and pieces and use it like that. So we're running close to the end of our time. So maybe we can quickly touch on one or two more things, and then I'll ask you where people can find you online and stuff like that. In your experience, before I ask you anything else, did you have more thoughts to add to what we were just talking about just now?
No, I think just generally it's like focus on find the tools that actually solve the problems you have. And if you find yourself like rubbing up against these issues where, you know, I think we've all come to that point where we're like exploring something and we hit this thing. And it's like, okay, yeah, I could do this, but it's going to take me a week to figure it out. That's probably the sign that you want to back off from that, especially if that's not your core responsibility. You know, so like the question I always ask myself is, what or how are these things going to improve my feedback loop? If they're not going to improve my feedback loop or allow me to work faster, then pass.
Oh, that's interesting that you frame it that way. Why do you think about it in terms of the feedback loop?
Well, because that's what, it's all that matters really, is the getting code into production, learning from production, and then repeating that process. So if the tools are not going to accelerate that, then look for something else.
Got it.
Yeah, right? That makes... So like, since we're talking about development, this is more like not for you, but for the next person who comes along. Like when they join the project, how much effort or how long will it take for them to get started, you know, building and shipping this project? Like maybe you've joined teams where like, oh, we have this onboarding documentation and maybe you can get your environment set up in a week or 2 weeks or a month, but you know, good luck. Somebody will help you if you need it, but we don't know if it will work, you know.
Right.
Contrast that to having something where like, oh yeah, you can get clone, run this script and your app is running. Which one of those would you prefer to work in?
Right. That's much nicer. It can be a little tough to justify the work sometimes because it feels like over-engineering sometimes, because it's like, this is not a need that's present yet, although I know that it will be a need at some point. And so that could be kind of a hard sell, maybe even to oneself, because it's kind of like insurance. Like you pay a big insurance bill every month and it's like, well, this is just a waste of money because it's not going toward anything. But then if you ever need to use the insurance, you'd be really sorry if you didn't have it. But still, that's a little bit of a tough sell sometimes.
It just depends on your philosophy or the way you think about it, right? So one of the things that's been really impactful for me, just thinking about like work as a developer or as somebody who works in software, is this quote that improvement of the daily work is the daily work. That like if you think about how you can, like what is actually causing bottlenecks for you and what you need to do, like what's inhibiting you, and then what can you do differently to resolve those bottlenecks such that you can build faster, ship faster, and get that feedback faster. Like that will always, always pay benefits.
That's very true. And I think that's a great place to end it. Adam, where can people go to find you online?
Best place is to subscribe to my podcast, Small Batches. That's on smallbatches.fm, where I talk mostly about all this stuff. I have guests on to talk about, you know, software delivery, all the different aspects of software delivery, business technology, and the intersection of all these things, such that, you know, you can learn to build and ship software faster.